You know, I want to pick up where we left off in 2 Chronicles. We actually left off in this chapter 13. And I know that poor Kevin, he's pulling more of his hair out every time he comes to Bible study, and I try to pronounce Rehoboam and Jehoboam. I always get those wrong. It's supposed to be Rehoboam. I don't know. It's just, I must have a mental block. I must have a screw loose or a gene missing or something. I cannot pronounce these guys' names right. But, you know, just for the heck of it, I'll just throw this out here. I got this out of the paper up at Clear Lake this past week. This lady's name, it says here in this paper, I cut this little article out, it says, woman's name is too long for a license. A Hawaii woman last name is a real mouthful, containing 38 characters and 19 syllables in all. It's so long that she couldn't get a driver's license with her correct name. And here we go. I'm going to really butcher this one. It's Kihana I Ku K U All K Hi U Lai He K A U Ali. Now that's her name. That's her last name. So just be grateful, Kevin, that I don't have to pronounce that word.
They have an excuse for that one. John, they have less letters than we do.
Yeah.
The first three letters of the Hawaiian alphabet are A-E-H. Yeah. They have all the vowels, but not the
three. Yo, she's got 36 letters in her name, and I don't know how many.
I heard a lot of vowels.
Yeah. 19 different syllables is like, oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm not going to get it right, so just bear with me. But anyway, I just want to pick up where we left off in this 2 Chronicles chapter 13. But you need to keep this in mind because, like I said, going through this portion of Chronicles, we're going to be dealing with the kings from the north and the kings from the south. In other words, the kings in the north, they refer to as the kings of Israel. The kings of the south, they refer to as the kings of Judah. And just keep this in mind, you know, in case anybody hasn't been here for a while. But the kingdom has now been split. It's been under a judgment from God because of Solomon and all of his idolatrous practices. And then his dynasty was basically ripped from him. God allowed, for David's sake, the southern kingdom, Judah and Benjamin, would remain, the southern tribe would remain in Solomon's dynasty, or basically his descendants. But then it was split because Jeroboam up north, he ended up having 10 tribes up there. So we're going to be going back and forth with these kings. But I still think that if we look at it and analyze it, this is given to us for our instruction, for our edification, for our reproof, for our example. And look at it from a perspective that when a nation is really doing its best to honor God, to glorify God, to obey God, to follow God, that nation is going to end up being blessed. And there's going to be peace and there's going to be prosperity. And people are genuinely going to be fulfilled and happy. And they're going to be prosperous. That's usually the way it goes. But then here's the, I don't know, just the irony of the whole thing is that when a nation really tries to honor God and God really prospers them and blesses them, well, then it becomes their biggest danger. Because once they get prosperous and once they get wealthy, or they really get their bellies are full, and then there's the real danger sets in. Then it's just almost like it's just a foregone conclusion that now you're going to gravitate to the very things that are going to be displeasing to God because of your prosperity. I mean, I've said it many times over the years that people can handle adversity much better than they can handle prosperity. It's just the way it is. I mean, how many people, when they become prosperous, it just ruins them. But a lot of times in people's difficulties and their trials and their setbacks and their heartbreaks and disillusionments and struggles, a lot of times they'll cling to God. But then when they really become fat and sassy, then they just feel like they have no need for God. And the reason I'm just even sharing this is because this is what you're going to see. You're going to see a situation where you got one lousy king after another, both in the north and in the south. And before we get into this chapter 13 of 2 Chronicles, just back up to verse 15 of 2 Chronicles chapter 12, because this Rehoboam, he was the son of Solomon, all right? Mm-hmm. And he's the one that became king of the southern tribes. It says in verse 15, now the acts of Rehoboam, from the first to the last, are they not written in the records of Shemaiah the prophet and Iddo the seer, according to the genealogical enrollment? And there was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam continuously, and Rehoboam slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David, and his son Abijah became king in his place. And I wanted to refresh our memory of what happened there, because when Solomon's son died, this Abijah took his place. But if you read in Kings, his name is Abijam. All right, I just put it up there. But sometimes the spelling is a little bit different, but it's the same. It's the same guy. But I just mentioned this in passing too, because it really is amazing the way the Bible records one king after another in terms of his death. It always says that that he slept with his fathers. Look at that, verse 16. And Rehoboam slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David. And that's the term that the Bible always uses to refer to death. And I don't care whether it's Old Testament, New Testament, that's the word that's used, is sleep. And what that very graphically implies is that there's going to be awakening. You're going to wake someday. There's going to be a resurrection. But understand this too. When a person dies, their body is asleep, but not their soul, not their spirit. Their soul, their spirit, either goes to be with the Lord, or it goes into judgment and it goes to hell to await the resurrection, because there's going to be a resurrection of the righteous and there's going to be a resurrection of the damned. And people, they just never really give it a thought. I mean, I know there's been times when the devil's just pounding on me, and sometimes I just feel so discouraged. I wonder sometimes, can I keep going, you know? And there's been times when I just have just gone to a graveyard where there's nobody around, and I would just stroll through a graveyard, and I would just look at every single headstone, and I would just read the names. But what I really read is the dates. Born such and such a date, died such and such a date, born such and such a date, died such and such a date. I read 2 or 3 papers a day, and I always read the obituaries, and people say, well, you're just morbid. No, because the Bible says the wise man thinks much about death, and the fool only thinks of having a good time. And I really think that people really need to stand back, take a good, hard, cold look at the reality of death, and say, you know what, one of these days, I'm going to be 6 feet under the frozen ground. And then what? We got to come to grips with the purpose of our life, of our existence now. Otherwise, we're going to find ourselves on the wrong side of eternity, on the wrong side of history, and we're going to find ourselves as being the biggest fools that ever lived. If we never take the time to investigate, well, who am I? Where am I going? What's going to happen to me after I die? What's life all about? I mean, how many people really seriously ask these questions? There's not that many. I mean, people are almost like unthinking cows, just staring off in the distance, just chewing their cud. It's like it's gazing at a TV or mindlessly, you know, staring at their computer or their cell phone. You know, all that stuff's fine. I'm just simply saying, man, is there something more to life than is it true blondes have more fun? I mean, is there something deeper to life than just talking about the weather? This is what I mean, yeah.
I think one of the reasons God didn't want us to live in a sinful condition forever, so he says it'll be a short, you know, you're going to die and there'll be a judgment, but also I think God wanted, he allowed, when we sin we die, but he allowed us to die physically because he wants us to know, realize there's something wrong here. I mean, because he knew the generations that would come would forget and, and try to get themselves all distracted with all the fun things. And that little death thing that nobody can avoid is supposed to be like a little indicator of something you might want to figure out. Something's wrong here.
Yes. I mean, that's all there is to it. But, you know, in Ecclesiastes, we are told very clearly in Ecclesiastes chapter 12, this is what Solomon says, remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, when you say, I have no delight in them, and before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain, in the day that the watchmen of the house tremble and the mighty men stoop, the grinding ones standing idle because they are few, and those who look through windows grow dim. In other words, he's speaking metaphorically here, and he's referring to our body as a house. He's referring to it as a house. And he says, remember your Creator when? In the days of your youth, before the evil days come and you no longer enjoy living. The evil days is when you get up in age to the point where your brain cells aren't firing the way they used to. A lot of people end up with Alzheimer or dementia. They, you know, mental capacity begins to deteriorate. Their body begins to deteriorate. And I like the way that Solomon describes it when he says that the evil days come and the years draw near when you say, I have no delight in them. You know, you're just getting old and you got nothing to look forward to. He says, before the sun and the light and moon of the stars are darkened and clouds return after the rain. In other words, you know, your eyes grow dim and the clouds return after the rain, meaning, you know what, there's no silver lining in anything. There's nothing to look forward to. I mean, I've been in and out of old folks' homes, retirement homes, and these places, you know, visiting people and praying with people. And I'll tell you what, it's sad because they just are slumped over in a wheelchair or laying in their bed or just dragging themselves along with a walker and are just, you know, staring mindlessly at a TV or gazing out the window. And that's sad. It really is. But we're all going there. We're all getting there. And it says in Ecclesiastes chapter 12, in a day that the watchman of the house tremble, the watchman of the house, the King James says the keepers of the house. The keepers of the house are our hands. I've dealt with thousands and thousands of people on my job. And I'll tell you, I see a lot of old people, their hands are shaking. It always says, in the day that the watchmen of the house tremble and the mighty men stoop, the mighty men are our legs. And you see these people that are, you know, they're shuffling along. If they're not using mark carts or walkers or wheelchairs, they're just shuffling along 6 inches at a time, right? And the grinding ones stand idle because they are few. What are the grinding ones? Your teeth, you know. They didn't have orthodontics back in Solomon's day or dental implants or dentistry or, you know, that type of thing. And he says, and those who look through windows grow dim. In other words, your eyesight begins to fail. He says, the doors of the street are shut as the sound of the grinding mill is low. In other words, you lock yourself in because of the terrors that surround you, you know, and also the sound of the grinding one is low. In other words, you start losing your hearing. My poor dad, he's almost totally deaf. You know, he's got to wear hearing aids. But it was through the war that he, you know, had a lot of ear damage. And now it says the grinding mill is low. Well, grinding mill is something that makes a lot of noise, but they can hardly even hear that. And it says, and one will arise at the sound of a bird, and all the daughters of song will sing softly. In other words, old people, you know, they're not young and dumb anymore. I mean, they can't, you know, work all day and dance all night. You know, they go to bed early, but then they rise up early, and a lot of times they suffer from insomnia, right? But then it also says the daughters of song will sing softly. In other words, women who really can project their voice in a melodious way when they're young, you know, they sing in a choir or whatever, now they can hardly even sing at all. In other words, they will sing softly, right? And furthermore, men are afraid of high places and the terror of the road. In other words, senior citizens, you don't find any daredevils when they're up in age, right? Sometimes I get driving behind some senior citizens and I got to pray for patience. They're all over the road and they're going so slow. And you're, oh, Lord, that's going to be me in 20 years or whatever. And it says the almond tree blossoms. In other words, your hair turns all white and the grasshopper drags itself along and the capybara is ineffective. In other words, that was an aphrodisiac. That's not going to work. In other words, your sexual powers greatly diminish. He says, for a man goes to eternal home while mourners go about the street. And that's a sad thing. You know, I just buried my mother, and I've buried my mother-in-law, my father-in-law, two of my sisters-in-laws, and I buried friends and stuff. And I know on my way to work every day, I would just pass their graves. Well, not my mother's, you know, but you pass their grave and you don't even think about it anymore because the mourners go about in the street, man. You got all these responsibilities and everything you got to do. He says, remember him before the silver cord is broken and the golden bowl is crushed. The silver cord, that's our spinal cord. And the golden bowl, that's our mind, that's our brain. How many people suffer from Alzheimer's or dementia, right? And he says, and the pitcher by the well was shattered. The pitcher by the well is our heart. And it says, and the wheel at the cistern is crushed. In other words, our circulatory system, all of our arteries and capillaries and veins, this type of thing. Let's face it, if we live long enough, chances are we're going to either die of heart disease or die of cancer, right? He says, then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. See, go all the way back to Genesis. God said that from dust thou art, to dust thou shalt return. You know, we didn't evolve from some snot of the gorilla, man. We evolved with God. God created man out of the dust of the ground. He says, from dust thou art, to dust thou shalt return, right? Okay? And I think I read somewhere that about 90% of household dust is dead skin cells, you know. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I'm always sweeping you guys up and throwing you out the door, man. And he says, and then he goes on to say, vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. Now, I didn't intend on getting into that, but I do think it's significant when you're talking about one king after another, after another, after another, and it says, and he slept with his fathers, and he slept with his fathers, and he slept with his fathers. Now, these guys were the rich and the famous and the powerful and the influential, you know, and whether these guys reigned for 50 years or 15 minutes, it's just 15 minutes of fame. Then what? Then you've got to account to God, because Solomon does say at the end of this chapter 12 of Ecclesiastes, he says, in addition to being a wise man, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, and he pondered and searched out and arranged many proverbs. The preacher sought to find delightful words and to write the words of truth correctly. The words of the wise men are like goads, and the masters of these collections are like well-driven nails. They are given by one shepherd, and that shepherd is capitalized here. But it's like what we're doing right here. It's saying the words of a wise man are like goads. In other words, we're reading God's word, and it's filled with wisdom, and it's like a goad. What's a goad?
A prod.
Yeah, it's almost like a fireplace poker that you would prod animals with, right? It's a goad, to goad them in a certain direction. Well, the fact that we get together to read God's word, it should act as a goad, to goad us in a certain direction, or, you know, a certain behavior, that type of thing. And then he goes on this, but beyond this, my son, be warned, the writings of many books is endless, and excessive devotion to books is wearing to the body. And I think that's pretty significant, because we're living in a day and age where it's just information overload. Just information overload. I mean, I would go into bookstores like Barnes and Noble's or Borders books, and there's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of books, man. And look at all the programming on the TV, on the computer, on everywhere you turn, it's information overload. And what this is saying to us, you know what? We have to be extremely selective in what we read and what we focus on, or what we give our attention to, right? Because there's just so much out there that's totally worthless. It really is. And he says, the conclusion, when all has been heard, is to fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person, for God will bring every act into judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or is evil. And the reason I even talked about that is because we're talking about death, and we're talking about how these kings, they're all pushing up daisies, but they were all very much alive and well, and very much rich and famous and powerful and influential, you know. So you got to look at life, you got to look at it from the spectacles of death, because it, you know, just keeping that in mind when we're dealing with these kings. Because that Second Chronicles chapter 13, it says, in the 18th year of King Jeroboam, Abijah became king over Judah. Now this is what, like I'm saying, they're talking about the 18th year of Jeroboam, the king up here. Well, in his 18th year reign, then that's when Rehoboam died, and that's when Rehoboam's son Abijah, or in Chronicles or Kings it says Abijam, he began to reign, and he reigned 3 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Michalah, the daughter of Uriel of Gibeah. Now there was war between Abijah and Jeroboam, and Abijah began the battle with an army of valiant warriors, 400,000 chosen men, while Jeroboam drew up in battle formation against him with 800,000 chosen men who were valiant warriors. Now here's the thing, that this is another judgment on what's happening to this kingdom here. It's split in half, and now there's this constant bickering, and there's wars, and there's conflicts, and there's fightings. But this is what always will happen when we begin to forsake God and begin to worship God in our own way. Because look at our country. Look at it. There's no peace anywhere, right? I mean, we just picked up the paper the other day, and, another mass killing. And our whole country is plagued with what? It's plagued with all kinds of distress and all kinds of problems and all kinds of crime and murder and this type of thing. But does anybody have the good grace to say, you know what, this is spiritual, man? It's because we're getting further and further and further and further away from God with all of our laws and our ordinances and our defiance against him, and we're acting with more and more hostility towards him. And nobody seems to have the good grace to say, you know what? What's happening to our country? This is all a result of what we're doing against God. Does anybody see that this is the hand of God trying to get men to wake up and get back on their knees and get back to him? Not too many people, right? Yeah.
In this crisis we had 5 years ago, the economic crisis, there's some economists that are talking now that they say in the next 5 years, because of this, all this spending and the Fed doing all that, we could have a huge crash. It's going to make the last one look...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's just, you know. Right. I mean, even if people, they don't believe in God and all this, I mean, they feel it. They sense it in their gut. Things just aren't going to get better, regardless of how much we try to, you know, get our pom-poms out and, you know, start cheerleading. And, you know, that we're all going to, you know, somehow, you know, turn things around, the economy. Oh, that's baloney, man. It's all going to get just get worse and worse. And people say, oh, hey, I'm just an eternal pessimist. But I'd say, no, I'm a realist. I just look at what's happening, and I know what's going on behind the scenes because I have the guts to believe what God has said. And we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but all these spiritual forces of wickedness that are just hell-bent on destroying us. And then he says in his verse 4 of 2 Chronicles 13, he says, then Abijah stood on Mount Zemaraim, which is in the hill country of Ephraim, and said, listen to me, Jeroboam and all of Israel. Do you not know that the Lord God of Israel gave the rule of Israel over to David and his sons by a covenant of salt? Yet Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, the servant of Solomon, the son of David, rose up and rebelled against his master. And worthless men gathered about him, scoundrels who proved too strong for Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, when he was young and timid and could not hold his own against them. So now you intend to resist the kingdom of the Lord through the sons of David, being a great multitude, and having with you the golden calves which Jeroboam made for gods for you. Have you not driven out the priests of the Lord, the sons of Aaron and the Levites, and made for yourselves priests like the peoples of other lands? Whoever comes to consecrate himself with a young bull and seven rams, even he may become a priest of what are no gods. But as for us, the Lord is our God, and we have not forsaken him. The sons of Aaron are ministering to the Lord as priests, and the Levites attend to their work. Every morning and evening they burn to the Lord burnt offerings and fragrant incense, and the showbread is set on the clean table, and the golden lampstand with its lamps is ready to light every evening, for we keep the charge of the Lord our God, but you have forsaken him. Now behold, God is with us at our head, and his priests with the signal trumpets to sound the alarm against you, O sons of Israel. Do not fight against the Lord of your fathers, for you will not succeed. But Jeroboam had set an ambush to come from the rear, so that Israel was in front of Judah, and the ambush was behind them. When Judah turned around, behold, they were attacked both from front and rear. So they cried to the Lord, and the priests blew the trumpets. Then the men of Judah raised a war cry. And when the men of Judah raised the war cry, then it was that God routed Jeroboam and all of Israel before Abijah and Judah. When the sons of Israel fled before Judah, God gave them into their hand, and Abijah and his people defeated them with a great slaughter, so that 500,000 chosen men of Israel fell slain. Thus the sons of Israel were subdued at that time, and the sons of Judah conquered because they trusted in the Lord, the God of their fathers. Abijah pursued Jeroboam and captured from him several cities, Bethel with its villages, Jeshana and its villages, and Ephraim and its villages. Now, before we go any further, I wanted to read that far down, just, you know, because like I'm saying, now this kingdom is split and now there's war that's happening here. But I think what's kind of interesting, you've got a situation here where in Judah, Abijah's got an army of 400,000 men, but he's outnumbered 2-1. He's outnumbered with an army of 800,000 men. But then Abijah really, I think, rebukes the king of the north, or Jeroboam, by just simply saying, you know what, you guys have broken away from the Lord. You set up these stinking golden calves, and they're not gods, and you've made your own priesthood, and you defied God, so God's not going to be with you. And now, just keep in mind about this Jeroboam. The reason he set up these calves over here in Dan, right there, with the northern tip of Israel, and also down here in Bethel, is because he didn't want people going down to Judah the way they were required to do. Go down there to Jerusalem 3 times a year to worship the Lord. That's what they were required to do. But he was really fearful that if people really started doing that, that they would eventually decide, you know what, we want to be one kingdom again. And then they would assassinate him and put an end to his dynasty. But this Jeroboam, he should have trusted God, because God promised him, look, if you just obey me and do what I tell you, all right, then you will succeed. But no, look at him. This is what happens with people when it comes to power. There's that old saying, power corrupts, total power corrupts totally. I mean, there's not hardly anybody that can handle that power. I mean, it really, really is amazing. Mm. I mean, I often have entertained the thought, well, you know, what if I could have all power? Oh, sometimes I'd really like that. You know, what's that?
Run.
Yeah, right. Because here's the thing. You know, when you really stop and think about it, it's like it's a real comforting thought to know that the one who has all power is also all goodness.
Right.
And if I had, let's just say I had the opportunity to have the choice, if I could have all power, I would not take it because I would say, I'm not good enough. But look at people who were just clawing to get a hold of that 15 minutes of fame, get the power, get the prestige, get the there's nobody good enough. But when a person is in power, all right, is in a position of authority, especially if they're a king or they're a president, God gave them one antidote. He said this in Deuteronomy chapter 18. He said this, now it shall come about, and he's talking about when the people get into their land and get a king. This is what God says. Now it shall come about that when he, the king, sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself a copy of this law on a scroll in the presence of a Levitical priest. It shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by carefully observing all the words of this law and these statutes, and that his heart may not be lifted up above his countrymen, that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or to the left, so that he and his sons may continue long in his kingdom in the midst of Israel. Now, I think that's pretty darn instructive, because what he's saying here is when a king comes to the throne, he's to write out his own Bible, word for word, write it out, the law, first five books of Moses. And he has to have a Levitical priest, a scribe, standing over them, making sure that he does not add a word or omit a word. You know, he dots every I, crosses every T, and he needs to read it every day. Because if he doesn't, he's going to get puffed up with his fame or his power or his position or whatever, and it's going to go to his head, and he's going to abuse his power, or he's going to make all kinds of wrong decisions, right? Look at our country right now. I don't care whether it's down here in state capital. I don't care if it's down there in Washington, D.C., it seems like every decision they make is just, it becomes that much more detrimental to the welfare of this country. You just look at it and you're just watching this slow motion train wreck. You wonder how can people make these decisions, but nobody seems to have the good grace to know, to see that, you know why? It's because these people have no fear of God, right? And when it comes to God's word, they've taken it and they've thrown it behind their back and they've trampled it underfoot. His moral laws, his moral commandments, we are just at war with God. We are defying God and we're acting with hostility towards God. So this is what happens to it. And this is what happens to so many of these kings. This is what happened to Jeroboam. He set up these golden calves because he wanted to cling to his power. But all he needed to do was really cling to God. And he would have maintained his power. He would have been prosperous. Quite frankly, he should have had the courage and the guts to lead the people down south three times a year to Jerusalem. And lead him there. And put his life in the hands of God, right? And God would have protected him. There's no doubt about it. But here's what, look at this verse 17. Abijah and his people defeated them with a great slaughter. Now, even though Abijah is not really that great of a king as far as God is concerned, he is on the right side of history as far as worshiping where he's supposed to worship and the way he's supposed to worship in the temple, not at these golden calves. But it says here that 500,000 men of Israel fell slain. Now, the critic of the Bible is going to read that and say, well, that's baloney. That's just a total exaggeration. That can't possibly be true. And matter of fact, when we get into the next chapter, we're going to read about the Ethiopians who have an army of a million men. And people can look at that and say, well, that's just, total myth. There's no way that it could have had that many people, and especially 500,000 people die in this battle. And I'm saying, you know what? I don't think you really know history that well, and I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but I've got, a list of the, some of the bloodiest battles in history. For example, in Stalingrad, of course, that battle went on for a long time, but in Stalingrad, 1942, 1943, with the Germans against the Russians, there was 841,000 German casualties, and there was 1,130,000 Russian casualties. I mean, almost 2 million casualties in that conflict. And that's pretty recent. And keep this in mind, too. You could look at some of these Civil War battles. I don't care whether it's Gettysburg or Chickamauga or Chancellorsville or, just a number of them, Antietam. And tens of thousands of people died in these battles, right? But you get a situation where even in these battles, they had rifles, they had pistols, they had artillery, they had cannons, right? But then when you get down to these battles that, you know, way before the invention of the rifle or the gun or gunpowder, it was really up close and personal, right? It was up close and personal. The, you know, the only thing that you could stand at a distance with would be a bow and arrow. People died in these battles by the tens of thousands because, man, you weren't looking down a scope of a rifle firing down 200 yards down the road. I mean, this was up close and personal. Yeah. So when you read these statistics here, people say, well, that can't possibly be true. Well, wait a minute. Put everything in perspective, and you can see, yeah, that's probably exactly what happened there in this conflict when you've got virtually a million men because you had, you got more than that. You got 800,000 on one side, 400,000 on another. You got a lot of people there, right? And that's usually the way they fought those wars back then, is they figure the bigger the army, the better chance of us winning. Well, look at how God judges this northern kingdom here. They lose 500,000 men in this battle. But does it change anything? Does it change them? It doesn't change Jeroboam. It doesn't change these people's hearts until finally God just had to destroy that whole northern kingdom, right? And I think this is given to us for our instruction. It's for our example. It's kind of like, hey, don't do what these people did, or you're going to end up in the same situations that they did. Total destruction. And now, just wind this down. We're going to read about the death of Jeroboam. It says in this verse 20, Jeroboam did not again recover strength in the days of Abijah, and the Lord struck him, and he died. But Abijah became powerful, and he took 14 wives to himself and became the father of 22 sons and 16 daughters. Now, the rest of the acts of Abijah and his ways and his words are written in the theses of the prophet Iddo. And just in concluding here, it says that that Jeroboam, he reigned for quite some time, with around 20-something years or more than that. But anyway, in the end, he died going down in infamy as far as God is concerned. And I don't think that wherever he is tonight, he is where he should be, because this is the way he died. But I also think it's kind of interesting about what happened in Kings. It gives us a little bit more insight here. It says this in 1 Kings chapter 14. At that time, Abijah, the son of Jeroboam, became sick. Now, this is Jeroboam's son, and his name was Abijah. Now, this is his son, but this is what it says. It happens to his son as a judgment against Jeroboam. It says, and Jeroboam said to his wife, arise now and disguise yourselves so that they will not know that you are the wife of Jeroboam, and go to Shiloh. Behold, Ahijah the prophet is there, who spoke concerning me that I would be king over this people. In other words, this is interesting to me, is that we remember reading earlier that it was Ahijah. He was a prophet who went to Jeroboam, and he tore up that cloak, right, into 12 pieces, and he gave him 10, says, God's going to give you the northern kingdom, right? Well, now the prophet is, you know, got up in age, and he's old, and he's blind, but now Jeroboam's son is dying. So he wants his wife, Jeroboam wants his wife to go speak to this prophet, but he doesn't want the prophet to know that that's his wife. Now, why wouldn't he want to do that?
His conscience,
because he knows that he has sinned against God continually with these golden calves and instituting his own priesthood and doing all this stuff. He knows. So now, when he wants God to help him, he doesn't want God's prophet to know who's asking for help. And it goes on to say this in 1 Kings chapter 14. It says, take 10 loaves with you, some cakes and a jar of honey, and go to him. He will tell you what will happen to the boy. Jeroboam's wife did so and arose and went to Shiloh and came to the house of Ahijah. Now Ahijah could not see, for his eyes were dim because of his age. Now the Lord has said to Ahijah, behold, the wife of Jeroboam is coming to inquire of you concerning her son, for he is sick. You shall say thus and thus to her, for it will be when she arrives that she will pretend to be another woman. See? Right? When Ahijah heard the sound of her feet coming into the doorway, he said, come in, wife of Jeroboam. Why do you pretend to be another woman? For I am sent to you with a harsh message. Go, say to Jeroboam, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, because I exalted you from among the people and made you leader over my people Israel and tore the kingdom away from the house of David and gave it to you, yet you have not been like my servant David, who kept my commandments and who did follow me with all of his heart to do only that which was right in my sight. You also have done more evil than all who were before you, and have gone and made for yourselves other gods and molten images to provoke me to anger, and have cast me behind your back. Now what it says, God said this, you to Jeroboam, you've cast me behind your back. Now what does that imply? Because I guarantee you that's exactly what the leadership of this country has done. Now when you cast God behind your back, what's the implication there?
You're taking the lead.
Very good, very good. It's not like, well, I don't believe in God anymore. I'm an atheist. You know, I'm now enlightened. Mm-hmm. You know, I just believe in UFOs and space brothers. No. Nothing like that. But when we cast God behind our back, is that what we did in our schools? We cast Him behind our back. We can't stomach the thought of God in our schools anymore. We don't want anybody praying, anybody reading the Bible. You know, so we cast Him behind our back. But now look, we've reaped the whirlwind now because of that. Our schools are totally ruined. That's because we've cast God behind our back. It's not like we've gone out and said, well, we don't believe in God anymore. But when we cast God behind our back, it shows a kind of contempt. Like, hey, don't tell us what to do. We're going to do what we know is best. All right? And don't call us. We'll call you. We'll keep you around like a cuddly mascot when we need you at a funeral, or, you know, call on you at a prayer breakfast for votes. But just don't put any demands on us. This is where we're at. This is exactly where these people got. They cast God behind their back, right? They treated him with that kind of contempt. And then it goes on to say in 1 Kings chapter 14, therefore, behold, I am bringing calamity on the house of Jeroboam, and will cut off from Jeroboam every male person, both bond and free in Israel, and I will make a clean sweep of the house of Jeroboam as one sweeps away dung until it is all gone. Anyone belonging to Jeroboam who dies in the city, the dogs will eat, and he who dies in the fields, the birds of the heaven will eat, for the Lord has spoken it. Now you, arise and go to your house. When your feet enter the city, the child will die. All Israel shall mourn for him and bury him, for he alone of Jeroboam's family will come to the grave, because in him something good was found towards the Lord God of Israel in the house of Jeroboam. Moreover, the Lord will raise up for himself a king over Israel who will cut off the house of Jeroboam this day and from now on. For the Lord will strike Israel as a reed is shaken in the water, and he will uproot Israel from this good land which he gave to their fathers, and will scatter them beyond the Euphrates River, because they have made their Asherim, provoking the Lord to anger. He will give up Israel on account of the sins of Jeroboam which he committed, and with which he made Israel to sin. Then Jeroboam's wife arose and departed and came to Tirzah, and as she was entering the threshold of the house, the child died, and all Israel buried him. Now, I just shared that in 1 Kings to give you a little bit more light about this Jeroboam and what God felt about him and thought about him. All of his household, every one of his descendants, were going to meet a horrible death, and they weren't even going to be buried. It says here the birds of the sky are going to, you know, feast upon them. It says this, anyone belonging to Jeroboam who dies in the city, the dogs will eat. That's quite a judgment, right? And he who dies in the field, the birds of the heavens will eat, for the Lord has spoken. Now, look at the way that this guy has treated God with such contempt because of his lust and his that driving ambition to hang on to his power, his 15 minutes of fame. And I'm telling you, man, it's a fearful thing to fall in the hands of an angry God. And I almost tremble for a lot of our leaders today. And I'm not trying to be anybody's judge, but man, I can see that they are acting with such hostility towards God. It's just incredible the type of hostility that they are displaying towards God. Right? Well, look at this Jeroboam and his end. You know, what? I was going to go through this chapter 14, but you know what? I'm not going to try it because I really kind of want to, if possible, get through three chapters next week, because I want to deal with this King Asa, and I don't want to divide up the story when we get into this King Asa, because he's actually starts out as a very good king, and he's down in the southern parties in Judah, but he ends up shipwrecked, and I don't want to break up the story. Now I have to keep going back and forth from Chronicles to 1 Kings, because the 1 Kings and Chronicles, they shed light on back and forth on one another. But does anybody have anyone to add or share to what we read tonight? Mm-hmm.